Welcome to the limited series of On Air. Our podcast brings together FemPilot professionals, mentors, and supporters for a conversation about career topics. We want to discuss different perspectives and see what we can learn from each other. Today, we'll talk about cultural bias. What assumptions do you think are made when it comes to culture, nationality, or ethnicity? What can people and companies stop or start doing to help everyone feel included in the workplace? We invited Teresa De Bardi and Alexis Jenkins to get a European as well as an American opinion on this. Teresa De Bardi is by profession a director at Deloitte Czech Republic, focused on transformations in finance and business services, and she co-founded the D&I Shapers, a platform which brings together organizations across the Czech market to move the DEI to the next level. Teresa spent more than half of her childhood abroad in Bangladesh and Egypt, worked with multiple international businesses. She's a woman in consulting, which still is a male-dominated business, and married a foreigner. All these provide her with a precious observation field for our cultural biases topic. Alexis Jenkins is the founder of ANJ Consultancy, a DEI firm that helps build inclusive and anti-racist workplaces, and she's the head of people and culture at Dame Products. By implementing storytelling, data, and analyzing a company's needs, she's able to use her professional and personal experience to build standards and policies for companies who are truly ready to begin the work. Alexis believes that leaving any facet of yourself at the door is a thing of the past. She resides outside of the New York City with her husband and a 2-year-old son. Let's do this! Hi, Alexis. Hi, Teresa. Welcome to our FemPilot podcast.
Hi, everyone. It's nice to be here.
Hello. Hello, everyone.
We have an exciting topic to talk about today, and I'm so glad I can do this with you too. I won't waste any time, and I'll just deep dive into it, and I'll ask the first question. How do you understand cultural bias? And maybe can you tell us some examples, some situations that can demonstrate it?
So my understanding of cultural bias, it was quite difficult for me when I was thinking and preparing for this podcast, like to, you know, differentiate between all the diversity and all the biases that we have. So when talking about the cultural bias, I understand it as making some assumptions based on the color of skin, on nationality, on language, on social status, on religion. And these assumptions are usually coming from some kind of generalization, like for example, and this is really those bias that I, for example, have seen in my life before, like Arabs are dangerous, Italians are lazy, or Czech women are easy to get. You know, these, according to me, are typical examples of the cultural bias. And the bad thing is that we tend to judge others based on our biases. And this has impact on the level of inclusion, on relations at workplace, and also personal life. And it has impact on the opportunities at work, in society, in politics. What is more to that there is also a big impact in economy of the culture biases. So, for example, you can assume that some products or services from certain country are with a lower quality or are even toxic for health. So these are also things that have huge impact on the bigger level of the society.
Yeah, I would agree with all that. And I don't want to repeat anything, but the one thing that I would say as well is that cultural biases are the frameworks that white supremacy has created to ensure certain people only remain at the top, right? So the way I look at it from the US perspective, the rhetoric that is shared about people that are othered, right? Those that are marginalized, those prejudices are constantly being fed to us, partly for us to remain suspicious, remain pushed away, to emphasize that there's a problem with those people, right? And so the structures and systems that are in place will keep those that are in power and wealthy there. And while the others struggle and fight the battles that were taught, and I'm using taught like in quotations, to keep the status quo. I think cultural biases are really, really hard to dismantle because they're embedded in everything that we do. You know, Teresa said it perfectly. It's, you know, as small as the little generalizations all the way to one's economic status or potential growth. It's everywhere. So I think it takes a lot of introspection. It takes a lot of self-educating, right? It's got to be beyond what's being told to us in schools or with professors. And it takes really diversifying your circle. I find that a lot of friends, a lot of my parents' friends, they're in very like homogenous groups. And that only perpetuates cultural biases. So when you diversify your social circles, your workplace circles, all those things, you then start to learn like, oh, those generalizations are like really off. Like they're really, really not accurate. So yeah, that's how I see it.
Maybe if I can add to that, so you, from Alexis, your perspective of the US, if we look in Europe, what was funny for me is also to realize that we have this intra-racial biases, you know, which we are like, there are white people that are in a kind of homogeneous group, and you would say that there are no biases, but there are a lot of also these intra-racial biases that were created during different periods of history. Just look at Russians, you know, that's how they are perceived in Czech Republic or in the post-Sovietic bloc, or the Germans with the Nazi past of, and so we are also like having and facing here in Europe, and obviously it would be seen also in US, I guess, this intra-racial biases that are still there and are somehow in the DNA and will be carried forward probably.
Oh my gosh, for sure. And I think the only problem, one of the ways to change that is for it to be mixed, right? I think of my biracial son immediately. He's not just Black, he's also white, he's Jewish, he's all of these things. And so just his actual like essence, his being is conflicting probably for so many people, right? Most people don't know that like Black Jews are out there. We're here, we're out there, we're all also not Ethiopian, right? So like there's that layer of it as well. But yeah, I agree. I agree with you. Like I said before, it's embedded. It's very hard to avoid.
Thank you so much for your answers. I'm really glad that we can learn from the European perspective, US perspective, and just see how we could build a better future. So Teresa, I have a question for you. Do you think here in the Czech Republic, Czech companies, if we generalize it, have a lot of bias against foreigners?
Yeah, I would say that the Czech people are quite tolerant and inclusive overall, like from my point of view. I think that there are different groups of foreigners that we can see here in Czech Republic. I'm from Prague, so that's also another maybe distortion, that Prague is something different than the whole Czech Republic. So there are different foreigners groups. And they are then perceived in a different way. Then there are also different levels in the Czech society, different education, different profession, and this all influences how the cultural biases are being also discussed and how people are aware of them. And also I would like to then distinguish like between this pure and intentional racism and more or less unintentional cultural biases. So I think that where I see the strongest and like where the biases are most visible are probably against those minorities that are quite big in Czech. So the Vietnamese, Chinese, Ukrainians, and Russians, and these minorities have a strong status also in the economy. And therefore, I think that they're very often target of some biases and some, let's say, maybe disrespectful comments or you know, some assumptions that are not impacting well their inclusion in the society. then there are biases against people of different color, definitely. But I don't think that it's something that is very much visible in the Czech society, because still like there are other minorities that are more visible than, for example, Black people or Asian people or Arab people from other nationalities than those that I have mentioned before. And again, I think in many ways, the other color of skin is sometimes considered also being more like attractive and somehow exotic. So I don't see really like a big, you know, racism or cultural biases in this way in Czech Republic. But as I'm saying, I'm from Prague and it might be a bit different in other parts of Czech Republic. But I see also that the Western Europeans or Americans are very often treated better than Czechs or other foreigners, because they are considered to be somehow bringing the good in the country and being so you like to go out with an American, you like to go out with a Spanish or Greek person, because it's something that gives the joy to life and so on. So I think that there are really different aspects of how we see other cultures in Czech Republic.
It's also what Alexis said about the mixture, about the representation, because when we have more, then it's just so normal.
Yeah, and Alexis, you can see that we don't even have the right language.
Yeah. Did you see? Yeah, I think my face made a face because one thing that I was thinking in my mind is like, wow, they keep using the word foreigner. And like, that's not a word that we typically, we have. But I would never use, because it's like, that feels a little degrading. Like, oh, they're a foreigner. You know, like that's, I would say maybe they're an immigrant. I don't even think I would say that. I would just be like, they're Puerto Rican, or, you know, they're Asian, or, you know, but this idea, like foreigner, just really stood out for me, because I thought to myself, like, I don't know the last time I've used that word in describing someone that isn't from the United States. I think I immediately just say what nationality they are or ethnicity before calling them an immigrant, or because an immigrant, using that word is like super triggering here in the States, right? Mm. Like we have immigration problems, again, using air quotes. And I find that to be laughable when this entire country is built on the backs of immigrants, right? And slaves, primarily. So it's kind of weird to think that I would say like, oh yeah, we have a foreigner working for us here. You know, it would just be like blank, insert person name, is working here now and they are from blank, you know? And keep it that way. So it's fascinating. It's really, really fascinating.
I think that it describes really well the maturity that we are at, like, we are at the beginning, because we opened the borders like, know, a few years ago, and we are at the beginning.
Right.
We are nowhere where the US is. And for us, maybe we don't even guess what country is the person from. So then we just like, you know, throw them in this one bucket. Like
foreigner. Yeah.
They are from somewhere else.
Somewhere else.
So yeah, you're going to have a lot of fun with us. And we really hope that it's not going to be in any way degrading.
No, it's just so, it's fascinating. I mean, historically, we had Ellis Island as a port for, to use your term, foreigners to come through and make, you know, their stake in America, right? And so I'm learning a lot. I love this.
Yeah, this is exactly the purpose why we're having this, so that we are also more mindful about the vocabulary that we use. Alexis, one more question for you. So you already mentioned that you're Black, you're Jewish. Have you experienced any unfair, bad behavior towards you based on your background?
Oh, 100%. I think when you're born Black, you're just, ready to be basically disrespected and assaulted to some sort of capacity at some stage in your life. You know, the first time I was ever called the N-word was, well, the first time I was told that, you know, like someone couldn't touch me because I was Black was first grade. The first time I was called the N-word was fifth grade. And it continues to progress, right? My identity in high school and middle school was always questioned. I was labeled an Oreo, you know, Black on the outside, white on the inside, because of the way I speak and the way I dress and, you know, just, I guess, my swag. And so all of that took years and years of unpacking. And I basically came to this realization around college where I cannot apologize for who I am. I'm certainly not going to apologize for the race that, you know, God decided to make me, or, you know, whatever the universe decided to make me. You know, I like being Black. I think it's super cool. I like being a female. I think being a female is dope. I am, you know, cisgendered, and I, you know, I love the skin that I'm in, and I feel like that is a privilege within itself. And then my path to Judaism, like I tell my rabbi all the time, you know, I was born Jewish, but I just had to go fill out the paperwork. So I was born in like a Christian family. But that was always inside of me, right? And so I did the due diligence. I converted, I did my mikvah, I did everything. And, you know, I'm a practicing Jewish woman. And so I, and that comes with its, you know, complications, right? You know, right now the people throughout the world, and particularly in the United States, are, in my opinion, speaking out of turn when it comes to the Israeli and Palestinian conflict. I think it's something that Americans need to just sit back and listen. We can't really speak of it with an American lens because there's so much historical context that we will just never truly understand. And so for me, I respect my religion, I respect my culture, and I'm willing to learn. And that's my methodology of continuing to learn the process. It's not my place. I said this to a friend the other day. It's not my place to have an opinion on everything, right? Like, why do I need to have an opinion about everything? I don't care about a lot of things. So why would I give my opinion on it, you know? And so I think that mindset has really protected me over the past, probably I'd say decade or so, of just knowing, like, you know what, my opinion doesn't matter here. So let me sit back, listen, learn, and move on with my day and my life, right? Because we all have certain privileges. I'm not an expat living in another country and having to deal with the systemic racism that could potentially be there. That's not my story. I am heterosexual. I don't have the story of an LGBTQ individual. I can appreciate, listen, and learn from those stories, but in my opinion, does not matter about their journey, right? It's only how I treat another person. That's what matters. That's the crux of it all. But I would also say, like, the most disrespected person in America is a Black woman. So from me being very young, it was always, you know, racism was there. It was unavoidable.
Thank you so much for sharing, Alexis. I think we in Europe also understand more and more that diversity and inclusion is important. We often use it within companies, because also we spend half of our waking time at work. So I think company is a good way to start making a change. Why do you think diversity is important? Are there any disadvantages to it, Teresa?
Well, question if it's important. It is important. because if a company says that it's not important to have a diverse workforce, it can also be understood as it is not important to be innovative or creative or open to new ideas. And so I think that diversity is really, like, nowadays the business imperative, that it's not anymore an option. and organizations and society needs to be diverse to survive and be inclusive and equally treat their employees to survive and to be successful. And like for the disadvantages, I don't really think that it is a disadvantage, but it might bring a big discomfort or even like doesn't make sense to organizations that want to stay local, that want to stay rigid, and for some reason they need or they can stay in their status quo. For example, public services, state organizations, or some like really big local companies with the local presence, and these will maybe adopt the diversity and inclusion later on. The diversity and the whole like story around it to make the environment in organizations more inclusive, it is a big discomfort. So the change is a big discomfort as any other change, because it means really to change culturally, to change the way how behavior of each individual will need to be changed, and if there is need of culture and behavioral change, it will always accompany with some pain. And one more thing maybe to understand why this is so complex and why it is so difficult is that this behavior that we need to change is only some kind of top of an iceberg. So you can see like the 20% maybe above the water level. This is the behavior, but below the water there are the beliefs, the biases, the motivations, some social role, and we need to influence these values and these priorities to reach the organizational change or the behavior change of each individual. And there comes with discomfort. So I don't think that there are disadvantages, but it might be more comfortable to stay where you are, you know?
Yeah, I agree with that. And I think, you know, for me, diversity, I mean, first, they're two separate things. Diversity is really bringing representation to the forefront. Inclusion is that work that Teresa was saying underneath that iceberg, right? It's doing that work to make sure that we are not triggering or tokenizing the marginalized groups. I would say that is probably the biggest disadvantage of DEI work right now is the tokenization. And I'm sure that there are tons of others that I can't think of right now, but I think while companies are grasping to fix the representation problem, what they also are making a mistake in doing is leaning on their existing marginalized groups, like, hey, go fix this, you know, go speak to your people, bring in more of your kind, blah, 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 blah. And I think like super rude, right? That's triggering. It then leads people to think like, oh, okay, I'm only here to check a box. So my talent is not of value, but my race and my gender and my religion and my sexual orientation, though that's, oh, okay. Thanks for now letting me know why I'm here. So I think that's one disadvantage. As a DEI practitioner, I think it takes the first step that I do for everyone is really getting, I audit, you know, I like to see the state in which someone's at in their journey of being anti-racist and get an understanding there and then look at it, you know, find the delta for the workplace and see like, okay, you know, we're in the early stages, like people are like in the beginning of their wokeness. So we have a lot of work to do. Or okay, they're kind of getting it. They've listened to some podcasts. They've read a couple of books. You know, they're doing the work in their personal lives as well. Or there's a maturity, which I have yet to actually find quite yet. But there's a maturity level of just, oh, they're they are diverse and we're working on the inclusion matter, right? Like that would be the focus, or we're working on the equitable side of things or equity side of things. Yeah, understanding where a workplace stage is at is, I think, really, really important, because then that helps you strategize what needs to be done first, and, you know, set your priorities. I also think, you know, making more room at the table for those individuals to speak for themselves, not for their groups, right? Here on this podcast, I'm not speaking for all Black people. I'm not speaking for all Black women. I'm speaking for Alexis Jenkins, right? Like that's who I'm speaking for. And that's where my opinions and experiences and my knowledge base comes from. However, it's very much influenced by the work and tribulations of my people and of my gender. But I'm certainly not all Black women. You know, that's like, that's impossible. It's insane. Yeah, I think one disadvantage would be tokenization. But yeah, I mean, I've interviewed and at companies where C-level executives were very specific. They were like, yeah, I believe in diversity and inclusion, but only for a certain, you know, level within the workplace. Like, I don't think like C-levels can really focus on diversity. And I'm like, okay, this is not a place I can work at, right? Like this, that is like systemically the problem. And being able to be candid and say that to, you know, the person that was interviewing me, the CEO of this company, and saying like, I wholeheartedly disagree and we will not be able to work well together because my values and my methodology is on the other side of the spectrum of your own. So best of luck, but like that, like this is not gonna work. And I feel sorry for any marginalized group that will potentially work at that company because the CEO doesn't believe that they can potentially grow, that they won't have that seat at that table at their company as a C-level executive. And it's ridiculous.
Yeah, and Alexis, to what you were saying, these marginalized groups are very often those groups that are given this quota. So we need to promote more women in the leadership. And then these marginalized groups are gathering together on different platforms and always speaking like within the group. So I was on many conferences, the female conferences, yep. You know, and yep. there were so many like exciting speakers and stories, and it was great. And there was one man. And at the end of the conference, he just turned to the rest of the audience and he said, like, you are having so much great stories. It's so interesting. It's so good for me to be here as a man. Mm-hmm. But I'm here alone. And you have to speak. You have to speak to the other man. You can speak all the time to like each other and only reconfirm to other women that you are
great. Yeah. 100%. I agree. And I think that's what always those conferences and those summits are so important, right? We need the space. We need the space to feel psychologically safe and to share our stories. But I think he's also right. At the end of the day, we leave the space, we enter the real world where it's everyone and it's men. And I'll be honest, unfortunately, men are primarily the decision makers for most of these companies. So it's unpacking. I wish there were more of men at that conference, right? Where they could go back to their workplaces and say, you know, you guys, like this is a thing. And I hope, you know, for him, he became not an ally, but an accomplice. And those are two very big distinctions that I think the DEI space is now speaking about and working through here in the United States, where an ally is someone that's kind of on the sidelines, right? An accomplice, you're in the thick of it. Like you are going down in that ship with you, right? Like if I were to, God forbid, be arrested as an accomplice, it's because I was right there, right? Like I was driving the getaway car, right? Something of that nature. And so I think for him, it would be really important for him to become an accomplice and be in the thick of it and not just go to his, you know, people operations team or his HR team and say like, hey, I went to this really badass conference with all these women and like, you know, we should like give a stipend for more women to go and blah, blah, blah. And then like, I'm done, you know, going away. Like policy changes can be made and he has that influence that would be important. So, yeah.
And this is valid also for like cultural biases. And I think everything like this was a good example from my life and your life, Alexis. And I believe also Clara, you met something like this before. It's valid also for the other non-diversities.
It's those in power, right? Those in power eventually have to come to these things, you know, because yes, there's power in numbers and that can affect serious systemic change, but you also still need that influence.
Thank you so much for this exciting discussion. You both are in the D&I space. So this question is to talk more about your work in the companies that you work for. Do you have expats? Alexis, maybe. Is that the word?
Expats? Sure, yeah. Yeah.
Do you have expats in your... in your companies, and what do they bring to the table? Do you have any examples of how really it helped your company from within? And on the other side, have you ever noticed any biases towards those people or any bad behavior that you had to solve?
So from my point of view, I'm the head of people at a sexual wellness company, and we have a couple of expats or those that are non-American. And I would say that, you know, some of it is kind of layered. One layer of it would be making sure that they feel secure in their job, right? Because visas are very hard to come by, and especially sponsoring those visas, that's an expensive uplift for, you know, companies here in the States. So you always want to make sure that you have the person feeling like good and safe and as secure as you can, right? Like your job isn't necessarily guaranteed just because we paid for your visa, right? Performance still matters, but we want you to know that like we're here, we're supporting you, and we will figure it out. So there's that one frame. And then I think the other frame, which probably sounds a little silly, but I'll speak for myself that sometimes when I hear a certain accent, I inherently think that that person is like 10 times smarter than me. Like if I hear someone with a British or an Australian accent, I'm like, oh, they know their shit. They're like, oh, sorry.
Imagine how we feel with you right now. When we cannot explain ourselves properly.
Yeah, I just feel like, wow, they're just like, their brain is just like so much smarter than mine. So that is a personal thing that I always have to unpack first, is that their accent is just their voice. You know, it's not a measure of their intelligence, which is really like juvenile and naive, but that's where my brain goes. Because again, the schools and the stories and all of that, that I was, you know, given in my upbringing, put, you know, those with accents on a pedestal above Americans, and certain accents were like just smarter and things like that. So anyway, that's a bit of a digression, but I think, yes, we do have a few non-Americans working at the company. And I think that's something that we will continue to grow as long as our budget can provide for it. I think the wealth of knowledge is so vast when you come from a different country. You know, just the way that one can communicate, the methodology, you know, there's something, especially here on the East Coast, like we are super direct in what we want and what we need. But, you know, let's say, for example, I worked at an Israeli startup that was based in San Francisco, but many of our coworkers were Israeli or are Israeli. I thought I was direct. That was like times 10, right? And so I think to myself, like, okay, that there are those tensions that lie, right? So sometimes what I've done in the past is when anyone, let's say from the Israeli team was coming to the United States, it's like, hey, let's just have like a quick jam session and discuss like what are like American cultural things, like what are like, it's not to say don't say these things, although there are some things that like were on that list, but it's also like, you know, cushion feedback, you know, we like the sandwich method over here, you know, things like that, that you inherently wouldn't know because you're not from here, right? So I think just having those candid conversations are really important.
Yeah, and I think that this language stuff, it is a biggest barrier that I see in Czech Republic. And also when I look and at like my team, so I work at Deloitte and we are like, Deloitte is built as a partnership. So it's quite a local company. Yeah, mm-hmm. It's not, it's even if like we have the headquarters in New York, but anyhow, we are set as a local company, I would say. And but we are getting regionalized and we are getting global and we are getting like more international clients. For example, I work at Deloitte 11 years and 80% of my projects were abroad, like working with people abroad or, you know, working for international clients. So the communication language is English. But there are clients that require Czech language, which could be like big concerns, automotive, for example, in Czech Republic or some governmental offices and so on, that require Czech. And that's why we were not so much hiring foreigners, and the Czech language, even a few years ago, was still required, you know, in the job posting. It has changed. In audit of some of the companies, we still require Czech, but we are moving towards really becoming an international company in Czech Republic. And it's visible also on the structure of the team. So now we have 20% foreigners, which we cannot count. Like, I know that I cannot use the word foreigner, but you know.
Oh, you can. Yeah.
It's in my unconscious bias.
It's okay. And again, the only reason why I called it out is because it was just so, it was foreign to me.
Yeah, so we, and within this, we have 13% Slovaks, which the language is very close to Czech. Mm-hmm. So I would say that this 7% probably are those nationalities that don't have the same language as we have locally. And I think that this the language barrier is really the key there. So it requires if the person does not speak Czech or doesn't speak Czech on a business level, let's say, it requires that the whole team switches to English.
And before
the podcast, I checked that in 2019, I think there was some survey that only 10% from Czech Republic speaks English on C1, C2 level. So it does mean that you, if you need to switch in the whole communication of the team to English, it might be uncomfortable. So for some people that don't use English every day and to start using it in daily conversation, it's uncomfortable. And therefore, this is the number one in inclusion of the other nationalities that don't speak Czech, is to really, you need to switch. You don't, the situations where some person of other nationality comes to a meeting and the head of the meeting says, oh, let's switch to English now. Or what do you think, Alexis, would you manage Czech? You know, and the person feels already excluded because he is like the one, because of him, all the team needs to start to speak English. And so these are these small things that I think that is a habit. Yeah, it's definitely a habit that can be learned. It takes time. It took time also to us, but now our four new hires that are coming in next week is one Slovak boy, a guy from Germany, a girl from Bosnia, and a girl from China. And what is another thing that we are looking on new hires? on based on their individual uniqueness? What are the strengths that they're bringing to the team? What is so special about them? And we don't look anymore on where they come from, because we have resolved this language barrier. But I think that, and this is like the last what I want to say to this language topic, is that I think that the education in the languages, and especially English, also German, is very important. Like, and we are still far behind the Western Europe in this.
I can imagine. I mean, and we can move off this topic, but the thing that I think is so starkly clear for me is that at least you, each of you, have the capacity of being bilingual or multilingual, right? Here in the States, like, it's a privilege if you learn another language through school, right? A lot of schools don't even have that. And so I think, and then it's weird, depending on the language that you know, there's a hierarchy of, you know, like racism, of if it's cool or not, you know? So it's really, really fascinating. And I think it says a lot to also how far behind we are here in the States. Like, we're not asking our kids to adapt and learn other cultures. I'm actively making that change. My son starts preschool in the fall, and we found a language immersion school. So he has the opportunity to start learning Mandarin, you know, at the age of 3. I think that'd be important, right? Like, I think it would also be really cool. Like, I would want to learn it. There's a lot of work to be done everywhere, is what I'm gathering.
Yeah. And besides the language, which is obvious in the Czech Republic, when we talk more globally, what can the companies and should the companies do to make people of other cultures feel more included and welcome, and even hire more of them?
So something that I like to do with any new hire is, you know, asking what their comfortability level is of sharing, you know, their background and their just their culture, right? Because again, what I'm trying to avoid is tokenization. And I'm also not trying to put all of the work and onus on that individual. So I think what companies can do is, you know, start seeing people as people, and then all of the layers of people are the things that they can start making procedures and policy changes around. I think it's interesting because I am a practitioner that really shoots from the hip. I am very direct. I ask, you know, questions that some would probably be too afraid to ask, but I'm fearless in that sense because I want to learn, and that's how I always stage the conversation of, like, this question has zero intention of being offensive. The intention is for me to learn. And so when you have like a conversational contract, when you speak with anyone that is from a marginalized group, I think that helps. But yeah, it's an interesting question, because then, like, another thing that comes to mind is, like, how do you source for people, you know, outside of like your normal places of where you find top talent, right? So there are tons of job boards that, you know, give way to different groups, but I'm not being as direct as I'd like to be in answering that question, but I think it's a complex one because there are many different paths that one can take. I would say the best path to always take is whatever matches your company's core values. You know, here at Dame, one of our core values is to be compassionate for the collective. So I think about that every single day when I am wanting to increase representation numbers, when I want to be inclusive and have, you know, celebrations for June and it's Pride Month and it was just Juneteenth. And, you know, so I think about that a lot. So if you have really strong core values, I think that should always kind of be your North Star when you're entering the realm of like diversity, equity, and inclusion.
I'm the one from this corporation probably where we and I'm also in the D&I community within Czech Republic. So I see how the corporations usually address this topic. And what I see, and I would like to avoid, and I would like that all the others avoid, is resolving diversity because it's a topic, you know. This is the number one topic.
Because it's trending.
So, yeah. Yeah, and let's have D&I in the newsletter, and let's do something. Let's do some webinar, and let's join some conference. This doesn't resolve anything, and it only gives some kind of label to D&I topic. Like label, this is a promo. This is a marketing thing. Yeah. So.
Right.
What I would like to see, and what I'm also promoting and building at Deloitte, and I'm trying to work also with the other companies, is to have a strategic approach to it. So
yes.
Have a look before, because there is another layer that we in Czech Republic we feel a lot that there is coming the strategy from the headquarters. So we have a D&I strategy from, and this is not just Deloitte example. This
yeah,
example of many others.
Yeah.
Yeah. So we have a strategy, D&I strategy coming from US, and then it goes to the region. So we have also regional D&I strategy. But when you come really on the ground here in Prague or in Brno or Ostrava or whatever else, Plzeň, you see that there are different topics that need to be addressed in a different way. So if I have a branding, I have image branding, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Inclusive, and mm-hmm. there are like all people of color, and mm-hmm. there are
it doesn't match. That's what you're saying.
It doesn't match.
You're like no. Your audience. It's just gonna right over their heads because
yeah.
you're
yeah.
not even. It's not even hitting the topics of the region, and like I'm kind of sitting here giggling a little bit because it's like, yeah, of course, like you have a DEI strategy that's coming from headquarters, but no one from headquarters. Probably did the due diligence and work of speaking to the regional, you know, VPs or presidents first, and then going down to the nitty gritty of it's like there's an assumption being made in DEI work, and you're 100%
yeah.
right. It's boots on the ground that's going to actually make the significant changes and do the proper work. Yeah,
and I think that the global and the regional strategy even is not meant to be
right.
implemented fully. So this is again like look strategically on where you are at the moment. What are your biggest issues? What are the challenges that you face in cultural biases, for example, or is cultural diversity something that is a challenge for you in your company? If not if just have it on the list somewhere, but you don't need to resolve it, you know, as a priority. However, if I look then on the like individual things, as you said, Alexis, like from the hiring, yeah, like hiring and retaining diverse talent. If you don't have already a diverse talent, so having bigger diversity in your team, it will already bring you to lift the diversity and you know, the inclusion in daily life, because if you don't have it and you will talk to your team about how cultural diversity is important, they will look at you like,
what are you talking
is
about?
Mad or like,
yeah.
What happened to her?
Yep.
And you will do your emails rather. Yeah. So have more diversity to live more diversity, then definitely like education and training and showing how the inclusive behavior looks like. And bringing diversity to all that you do. So I have an example. I was yesterday on a CFO Congress and we had the Deloitte stand there. And I came there to the stand and there was my like friend from marketing and he had a small figurine. So it's like a small Lego and it was called Deloitte. And there was a man, like figure of a man with a tie and a suit and with the Deloitte logo. And he was handing it to me because I have a son and he knows it. So he was handing it. And he said, yeah, Teresa, I know. We didn't do the female version, but it's already in production and we will have it. So this is like example, like put mm-hmm. diversity in everything you do and always mm-hmm. think like, if I'm showing examples of my employees that were successful in their project, did I address only men or did I include also girls from the team? And and my learning from this is like, we are learning on the way. So we make mistakes and so we go forward to like
100%
learning every day.
Learning every day. And it like being okay with that, you're having to learn every day, right? Mistakes are going to happen. That's fine.
Exactly. Yeah. And the role models. Yeah, the role models, definitely. Like if the CEO is struggling to switch to English on the meetings because he prefers to talk Czech, or if the managing director keeps on excluding people, then most probably the change would be painful.
Yeah,
100%. Alexis, I want to also talk about the US because we talked a lot about the Czech Republic and our barriers. In your words, how has the US progressed since the Black Lives Matter movement? And what do you think can people in Europe learn from it?
Oof, heavy question. I think more conversations are being had, right? Which is really cool. I think we're seeing the younger generation come up and be a part of the cause and working at becoming more accomplices than allies, which I think is a really great example. I also kind of think like it's just business as usual at the same time. You know, it's hard now that it's summertime and the United States has opened up a little bit more with the pandemic. I think people are really, really fighting to get their old way of life back. And so when you're fighting to get your old way of life back, that means that the potential work that one has done throughout the course of last year, when things were hard and you were isolated and you could spend the time and doing these things, that takes a backseat, right? That gets put on the back burner. So what I'm observing is this really interesting blend of people who have been doing the work all throughout 2020, continuing to do the work, and others that are like, we've moved on. You know, like Trump is no longer in office. Biden is now there. You guys got Kamala. You know, like it's kind of like there's also that kind of sentiment in rhetoric, but I also don't want to diminish the fact that there are great people continuing the process. It's like what Teresa was saying, we're learning, right? And I think what's fascinating right now is that white people are learning to be more consistently uncomfortable when they never really had to be, right? You didn't know what you didn't know. Then the murders of George Floyd, Breonna Taylor, and countless others, those that we weren't televised and promoted, versus those, the few that actually did get promoted in like throughout the country and everyone knows their name and the hashtags, right? I think for them, there's like a layer of desensitization that's happening as well, right? It's just like, there's another and another. And so it's complicated, but I think that's historically the way things have happened here in the States. Something that I hear a lot of Black folks saying at this point is like, this is no longer my job. You know, this is the job of white people. You go do the work, you go do the readings, you go figure it out. Don't look to me to be the one to give you answers, because it's not my job to help you find that. And I really applaud that. I applaud that kind of energy, because it's not my job. It's not my responsibility. Because if I've been trained to learn both histories my entire life, then you can do the same, even if you're starting in your late 20s or, you know, mid 50s or whatever the case is. So it's really interesting. I'm hopeful. I'm extremely hopeful. But I think another thing that I am very proud of Black folks speaking of now is our trauma. You know, we are taking our mental health extremely seriously. And I am really loving seeing my Black sisters being able to articulate and say, I am not a superwoman. Stop expecting that of me. I am a person. I bleed the same color blood. I, you know, have my bad days. I am not a superwoman. And it's something that I admire so much. And I think, you know, I have to continue to practice as well, because there are assumptions or stereotypes that we as Black women can handle it all. And we do it all. And we do. But that doesn't mean there isn't pain. That doesn't mean that there isn't trauma. That doesn't mean that, like, we're not struggling. So our white counterparts have a little bit more of the ability to show that vulnerability, where I think for Black women, it's very difficult. I struggle with it on a daily, because I know, like, I just think the ramifications are quite large. You know, like, I remember reading Sheryl Sandberg's, you know, Lean In, and there's a paragraph or like a small page where she writes about, you know, being in Mark's office and crying, you know, to her boss. And I remember thinking, like, there is no way on God's greenest earth that I am going to cry in front of my boss and not have it, like, really affect my job security. You know, that's a privilege, you know? And so I think there's so much of that to unpack, and the work I think then is on me to show, like, hey, I deserve, like, equal amount of care and consideration as, you know, my white sisters.
It all, from what you said, goes back to what you said earlier, that it all starts with us, and it's our responsibility to see what we can do better, how we can make everyone feel safe. And it's not the minority's responsibility to, if it's women, if it's LGBT, if it's Black people, to educate others. So we all should educate ourselves. So I completely agree with that.
Yeah.
At the same time, biases of all kinds, I guess, are somehow embedded in our nature. But now a last and a little bit, like, philosophical and utopist question. How do you imagine a future with less culture of bias? And how would it feel, Teresa?
Is it even possible? I cannot imagine that we become such robots or machines where no biases. But I see a bright future and maybe possible future. I don't know if I will still be able to live it, but I hope my son will, or my grandson. So this future is, like, maybe having or being aware of the cultural biases and using them in a positive way, you know, like making sure that my cultural bias is not hurting anyone and not putting anyone aside or excluding someone, mainly, like, also driving some conflicts that are causing a lot of pain and lot of losses. But really, like, I would say, like, world without bias, I imagine it as some fact-based, robotic and evidence-based society, which, I don't know, it's not a lot of fun.
I'll be honest, I don't think that'll ever happen, because what we're then having to do is really dismantle white supremacy. And I don't think that's possible. You know, a story comes to mind. My dad, you know, grew up in the 60s and 70s and went through a lot of, you know, racial discrimination. And he and my mother made really smart, educated choices of where they were going to raise their four Black children. And where we were raised, it was beautiful, it was affluent, it was predominantly white, it was all those things. However, those same very similar discriminatory actions that he faced, I faced. And so what that tells me is decades can pass and you're still gonna get the same stuff, right? Like curriculums could change incrementally, but people are still going to treat others horribly because the curriculum didn't change at the appropriate stage, right? It didn't happen in preschool or kindergarten. It only happened in high school or middle school. People want to raise people how they want, right? I think about it a lot. I'm a new parent. I have my first kid, and it was harder for me to get like TSA pre-check and my driver's license than it was for me to become a parent. You know, like there's no class that you have to take before you become a parent. There's no like rules or regulations of like, are you a good human being to like then bring in another human being, right? And like, are you going to raise your kid as like anti-racist or not? There's none of that, right? So I think because that is the human process, right? You get to live life to a certain extent the way you see fit. I don't think that there is a world that doesn't have cultural biases, because so much rhetoric is passed on through word of mouth to children, right? I know what I say to my child has significant impact. It just does. You know, there's no way to circle around that. Then he enters the school system that's only going to give him X amount of learnings. And then he proceeds and grows and becomes an adult. So like, yeah, I don't think it's possible. I think, at least here in the States, like we're talking about dismantling like 400 plus years of, you know, yeah, I don't see that. But what I do see are more people like me who think about this so seriously and like are so conscious about the decisions that we're making. I mean, we are a generation that will boycott brands if they're not doing sustainable actions or if they have like systemic issues happening in their workplace, right? So like as consumers, we know we can exercise that muscle and use that voice and make those changes and force that hand. I think that's what we're going to see more of. I think we're going to see more, uprising is a dramatic word, but we're going to see more movements and uprisings of different pockets of things that we see that need changing. But like, until, you know, really wealthy white men want to make the laws different, yeah, I think my kid's going to go through the same thing that his grandfather and great-grandfather went through. It'll just be on a different caliber. So yeah, it's really a complicated question and it's a heavy question. I'd like to be pithy and like, yeah, you never know what the future holds, but like, I also know the truth. I know what has to change in order for that to happen. And that's changing the minds of millions and millions of people to think differently and to be more conscious and compassionate and empathetic. Right now, it's a huge debate in this country that critical race theory should be taught in schools. And like, people are pissed off. They're pissed off at like even the notion of having their fifth grader learn about like the Tulsa massacre or like, you know, the truth of what is going on or the Black experience. Like, that's upsetting people. It's upsetting people for their kids to learn historically what has been done. Like, these are just facts. They're not feelings, they're facts. And they don't want this to happen. You know, it's on the same layer of a lot of schools here in the States don't want to educate kids on, you know, sexual health. That's something that shouldn't be talked about. That's something that should, it's like, all right. And then we wonder why teen pregnancy is a thing. And then we build television shows fetishizing it. You know what I mean? It's just so, it's
so Clara.
Yeah.
Thank you. I'll go grab a wine.
Yeah. Basically nothing's going to change. So we might as well buckle in. No, but it's like, it's not the truth, right? We as individuals are going to change our little pockets and our little bubbles in our worlds. And that is impactful because at the end of the day, that makes us better and our people around us better. And it makes our lives enjoyable.
I learned so much. I hope our listeners did too. Thank you, Alexis. Thank you, Teresa. I hope to see you soon again and catch up about this and other topics.
Absolutely. Thank you so much for the opportunity.
Thank you very much. I'm so inspiring.
Have a nice day. Bye-bye both.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
And that's a wrap. But the fun doesn't have to stop here. If you have any questions, guest suggestions or feedback, shoot us an email to podcast@fempalad.com. To learn more about our community, head over right now to Fempalad Instagram or Facebook and get involved. Thank you for listening and join us for the next episode of On Air, a podcast by Fempalad.